Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. What to say about Kate White? Plenty. She's the New York Times best-selling author of 11 works of fiction, six of which are part of the Bailey Wegans mystery series, including the newly released The Secrets You Keep. Her other novels are psychological thrillers. Kate is also the author of popular career books for women, including I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, How to Ask for the Money, Snag the Promotion, and Create the Career You Deserve. As editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine, she knows what she's talking about. Kate's career in the magazine industry began after she nailed the Top 10 College Women contest organized by Glamour magazine. She appeared on the cover and was subsequently offered the job of assistant editor. Kate's held editor-in-chief positions at Working Women, Redbook, and McCall's. Kate joined Cosmo in 1998, and during her 14 years at the helm, increased the magazine's monthly circulation by 30%. During that time, she managed to work full-time and write 8 books, but in late 2013 decided it was time to leave and concentrate full-time on her writing and speaking career. So, let's meet and speak with Kate White. Kate, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sandy.
A good editor makes for a good writer. But how does one make that transition from a magazine, number one, to a New York Times best-selling career as a writer of mysteries and thrillers? I know that's a lot to throw at you, but we'll parse it out.
Well, it's actually interesting because I think there's some writers who, or editors, I should say, who don't write because they are two different skill sets. And a lot of editors are very adequate writers, but transitioning to fiction can be tricky because in fiction, it's all about showing, as they say, and in nonfiction, it's about telling.
And,
and that's something that's often mentioned in terms of writing. When you're doing nonfiction, or you're writing a magazine article like How to Never Lose an Orgasm Again, you start off with, hey, this is maybe an issue for you. Here's how you fix it, steps 1, 2, and 3.
Just the facts, man.
Right, just the facts. But great fiction, you don't often spell it all out. You create a mood. Mm-hmm. You just create a scene by not hitting the reader over the head with it. Mm-hmm. And that can be really tough to do. And I had to really practice to get the telling out of my writing when I tried fiction.
But I have to say this personally. I'm not a bad editor, but I'm not a very good writer. I find writing incredibly contrived for me. And even in an email, I'd just rather call you up on the phone. When I was doing news on the radio, it's just the facts, ma'am. I just can't imagine sitting in front of a computer and then just writing. I have nothing but awe for people like you.
I have to say it gets easier. For every book, you learn certain tricks to get your butt in the chair. Mm-hmm. Like I only am allowed another cup of tea once I've got maybe 2 pages done. So you set up a reward system. You just find little things that help you discipline yourself. One great trick someone taught me years ago, time management trick, was that part of the reason we don't achieve certain goals of ours is that we make the task too daunting and you need to slice the salami. And so for me, when I first started writing my fiction, I only wrote 15 minutes a day because I knew if I told myself, I'm going to write all Saturday morning, my kids are doing something and I'm going to do that, I wouldn't because it was too daunting. I'd find an excuse. But when I set the goal of only writing 15 minutes a day, it was easier.
And when that buzzer went off, you got up?
I got up.
You didn't extend it to 20 minutes?
No, but in time I did because I liked the process. It got easier. And now I can sit down and write 4 hours in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I think lastly, one thing that makes you do it is it, as tough as it is to write, the magic that happens sometimes where even if you've plotted it out, something in the storyline changes. Your brain tells you so-and-so's going to die, and you had no idea he was going to die too. You knew the main person was going to die, but all of a sudden somebody else is dying, and you think, wow, my brain did this crazy thing, or a character will present in a way you weren't expecting. And it's a breathtaking rush when that happens. And I think you sit down to write knowing that today may be one of those days where something like that happens.
I wonder on some level as I listen to you, is it, how can I say this? Is it presumptuous
of you, which is generic you, to think that you've got something to say?
Yes, definitely. And yet I've never thought that. It's more the urge to write.
It had to break out of you?
Yeah. Kind of? When I was a little girl, my mom told me one time that I had crayoned a piece of paper black. And she said to her, said to me, oh, honey, what are you going to call that? And I said, the hacienda is dark and the town is sleepy. And she said, it was like, okay, weirdo. But I think she always said to me at that moment, she realized I probably wanted to write. And when you want to write, you can't stop yourself.
I hear you.
And yes, you may stop yourself because you haven't set up the right systems. And what I say to anyone who wants to write and hasn't been able to, it may not be because you haven't got what it takes or because you don't really want to do it, but you may not have found what I call the writer's cocktail, what time of day is best to write, what kind of surface, silence or music. But if you want to write, it's often not because you think, I've got something important to say to the world.
You can't help yourself.
But you can't help yourself. In fact, if I found out my books only sold 10 copies a year, I would probably keep doing it.
Wow.
Which is so sad, but...
No, it's not sad because it's something you have to do.
Yeah.
But let's kind of transition to your writing career and go back in time. So when you were, not growing up, but when you were in college, what was publishing, were magazines something in your head that this is what it is I want to do? Did you have a sense of who Kate was?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Sandy. And one people don't generally ask, but when I was young, I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know what kind. I wrote little plays. I had a little play that was put on in high school. I wanted to write for magazines. I wanted to write for newspapers. I wanted to write books. And I didn't know that you sort of have to pick a lane because this was before the internet and you didn't have as many opportunities in a small town to figure it out. So part of the reason when my college asked me if I wanted to apply for the Glamour Magazine Top 10 College Contest and be their entry, one of the main reasons I said yes was, wow, this could be my ticket into magazines.
But why did they ask you?
Oh, because I was in the first co-ed class, and I was in a lot of activities, and I was the first woman on the all-college Senate. So they just thought, hey, Kate seems active.
And well-rounded.
Yes, well-rounded. So that became the ticket to magazines, and all of a sudden, there I was. I'm in magazines. So goodbye newspapers, goodbye books.
Did you read magazines growing up?
Yes, because my mom was a librarian, and she was so encouraging
to
me.
Oh, hello.
Yes,
okay.
And she used to bring me 17, and I'll never forget one time there was a cover line. Probably wasn't a cover line. It was a story in 17 called When Necking Turns to Petting. And I remember being so riveted to that story at 14. It was like, what happens when you get there? And that, you know, it was the exhilaration I got from reading magazines that made me wanted to do it, though I wanted to do other kinds of writing. So I sort of parked that at the door. When I got into magazines, I became a writer. And then I realized if you want to move up, you've got to be an editor. But I kept writing. And finally, in my 40s, I had a moment where I always advise people, because I talk about careers, to take some time every week to sort of step back and with a pad and paper and sort of think about where you are.
Assess?
Yeah, assess. Where do I want to be? Am I happy? Is there some girlhood dream that I want to still tap into? And it was during one of those moments with like a mug of coffee and a pad that I realized I want to tap into that old dream of writing a book and writing murder mysteries because I love Nancy Drew.
So, I grew up with her, too.
Did you go through every Nancy Drew book when you were
probably
young?
Did. What was her boyfriend's name?
Ned Nickerson.
Ned, okay, thank you for that. Yes, Nancy and Ned.
Yeah.
So that was in the back of your brain. And at some point, in it growing, and then at some point clearly festering.
Yes.
You know?
And another thing for me, besides, hey, I don't want to let go of this dream. I'm in my early 40s. If I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. I was in a precarious field. By now, I was the editor-in-chief of Redbook, and they fire editors-in-chief usually sometimes in their 50s or early 60s. It's the name of the game.
Because you're too old?
Yeah, maybe because they feel you're out of touch with stuff. Now, the Anna Wintour is an exception. I turned out to be an exception. I didn't get fired. But I didn't know if I would be, so I wanted a plan B. So part of why I started writing those books when I was still at Cosmo was because I wanted that plan B.
But wait a second. You have this street cred and track record, you know, that you went from this magazine to this magazine. That had to factor into your head somewhere. Not that I'm saying each magazine had its own circulation and a very impressive circulation. But as you moved along, clearly it's all being reinforced for you. You're not in the wrong field.
But you look around and some of the women I'd really admired, and men too, got bumped out in their late 50s, and I just wanted to be sure I had my butt covered. And so I had the plan B. Now they call that, Sandy, the side hustle. Have you heard that phrase?
No, I haven't.
A lot of millennials think I need a side hustle, and maybe one day I'll turn it into my own business. But for me, doing public speaking and writing those books were, for me, my plan B. Now, in the end, I got to make the choice. I got to point in my late 50s where I thought, okay, if I'm going to do it, now's going to be the time.
So you walked away from Cosmo.
Yes.
They would have been very happy to have you stay.
I don't know how much longer, but certainly they were open to me having another contract. But I didn't want to be one of those people who is booted out and then you end up feeling bad about yourself for no reason. And when you leave, and Cosmo was number one when I left, not number one now, I'm afraid to say. Mm-hmm. Though my old number two is now the editor-in-chief, and she's just been brought in, and she's going to do a sensational job with it. I got to leave, and it's sort of like when a guy dumps you who you didn't like that much anyway, and you're thinking of dumping him, but if he beats you to the punch, you feel bad. And I didn't want that to happen. So,
well, it's nice when you can call the shots. When I left Wins, I just woke up one day and said, I think it's time for me to go and do something else. And I was very happy there. And it was a mutual, satisfying relationship. But I felt I had to go. And it was very liberating to be the one who could say, it's been a great ride, but I have to go now.
Yeah. Besides the fact that the magazine business is really
hurting. Well, it's tenuous.
Yes.
Yeah.
But another thing, I do a lot of speaking on careers and success. And one of the things I say to people is often the time to look for another job is when you're happiest.
Well, when you're happiest?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We tend to think, no, when we're miserable, but often then you've run out of some key energy. When you are happiest, it means you know it frontwards and backwards. You're in a real comfort zone. You're not being challenged anymore. You're not learning. You're not growing. You're not having those wonderful surprises. And I wanted to mix it up and find myself in something really a little bit newer and scarier. But more importantly, I wanted personal freedom. I love my company. I worked for a fantastic company for 18 years, the Hearst Corporation. But working for myself is so great. The only downside, of course, was going to work for myself was I knew the boss was going to be a bitch. But
touche.
Yeah, but it's just been so delicious. And I live in Uruguay with my husband 3 months during the winter, and I do a lot of writing there. And he has a job he can do remotely too. So it's been great.
So all the stars were aligned for you when you made the transition.
Yes, though I would say to anyone who's thinking of, wow, could I do something like that, where pull the trigger, go out on my own, do my own thing, is you got to get some of your ducks in a row.
Well, somebody could very easily say to you, oh, come on, Kate, you were married to some audition.
But what I would say is I really saved. I really came up with a plan early on to save for this. Mm-hmm. I let other things go in order to do my side hustle, my plan B. I never learned Spanish as I had hoped I would. I never learned to play tennis. My kids never got a backseat, but all hobbies did. Mm-hmm. But it worked out that I had this side hustle so I could leave. So it was a really delicious thing to go out and be on my own and be my own boss.
When you started to write books, what came first?
Actually, I tried to write a novel in my 20s, and I just could not get it going. I couldn't, it just didn't work. And I think part of the problem was it wasn't a mystery. And so what I sometimes advise writers is figure out your genre. What's going to be the right thing for you? So an idea for nonfiction occurred to me, Why Good Girls Don't Get Ahead, But Gutsy Girls Do. I wrote in the 90s. It was a bestseller. And now we're going to re-release it. The publishing company Grand Central is going to re-release it, totally updated, next year. That helped me actually get the fiction contract, because I had a company that believed in me. And so when my agent and I said to them, gee, Kate has an idea for a murder mystery, they were open to taking a look at it.
How were you able to marry your full-time job?
Well, I have to say it was burning the candle at both ends. I only got probably 5.5 hours of sleep, and I'm not one of those people that brags about it. It was just, yikes, this is a little tricky for
me.
Well,
I only get 5.5 hours sleep because I can't get 6.5 or 7.5.
Yeah, well, sometimes it was only 5, too. So what I would do generally is when the kids were younger, I'd take them to school, I'd get to work, and my staff would not generally roll into about 9:15, 9:30. So I'd write an hour before they got in. And I would aim for one page, just get me one page a day during the week. On weekends, well, at night, too, I left work at 5:30 every night, would spend time with the kids. And then the downside was Cosmo was so massive, I had to work for a couple of hours after everybody went to bed.
You had homework.
Every single solitary night. It was a big job. And I couldn't just sort of say, I'm leaving at 5:30. There was always a pile. On weekends, I got up before the kids got up, and I tried to aim for 5 pages with the novels. And what kept me going was just the idea of, hey, you know what? This is going to lead to something. This is going to give me some freedom one day. But I also think if you do that, you can't sacrifice everything. I built a lot of pleasure into my life. We traveled a lot.
So you had a balance.
Yes,
for you.
I did. Mm-hmm. And I would say, too, to women, I wish I had done even a little bit more of that. Like, I would do certain days where I would sneak off from work and I'd have a massage and go sit at a bar and order a steak with a glass of wine for lunch. Mm-hmm. I found that really invigorating and rejuvenating. I probably could have done a little bit more.
When you look back at your career, when did you think that you died and went to heaven?
Not when I got the Cosmo job, but when my first issue's numbers came in. And I realized, wow, I get this. Because what happened, Sandy, is, and this is a lesson, and it's one I tried to learn for myself. I was the editor of Redbook, got called on a Sunday while I was making a blueberry pie out in Pennsylvania with my husband and kids. My boss is on the line, the president of the magazine division. Kate, I need you to drive into the city today and meet me in my office. Oy, you know, first thought is I'm being fired.
Yes, yes.
And I actually said to her, Kathy, if you're going to fire me, just will you do it over the phone because I'm in Pennsylvania? She said, no, I'm not going to fire you. I think you'll like this. I thought, oh, my gosh, you're going to put me in new media. So I said to my husband, I'm not the editor of Redbook anymore.
Do you remember what year that was?
It was 1998.
Okay.
So I tell my husband, I'm not the editor of Redbook anymore. Drive in. When they told me I was the editor of Cosmo, I almost died.
So this was so out of left field.
So out of left field.
So Hearst was the parent company of Redbook and Cosmo.
And Bonnie Fuller, who was the editor of Cosmo, was being lured away to Glamour. And there were no rumors about it. And they had decided, you know what, rather than try to keep upping the amount they're offering Bonnie, we're just going to go with Kate. Well, here the dirty little secret was I didn't really want it. I was terrified. When I went home that night, I said to my husband, God, you're not going to believe this. I'm the new editor of Cosmo. I didn't have a cell phone then. He gets this look on his face. He goes, wait, I'm going to bed with the editor of Cosmo tonight.
He died in one day.
Yeah. I think he thought, I've been handed the Kama Sutra and told, learn every position in every tree now on Monday.
Oh, God. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. But, Sandy, I didn't feel the same way. About a year later, we ran a story in Cosmo with the subhead, don't believe everything you think. And I know that if that job had opened up in the market, I wouldn't have gone for it because I didn't think of myself as ready for something like that.
Or did you not think of yourself as Cosmo material?
Cosmo material or creative enough to take on that big of a brand. And what I realized afterwards is sometimes when you find yourself protesting too much about something, you need to step back and ask yourself, wait, why do I think I'm not ready for that? Come on, why am I hesitating? Ask a friend, could you see me in that role? And I think you just have to face the fact because sometimes your doubts override the reality that, yeah, I was ready. And so the pivotal—
Well, they don't suffer fools gladly.
Right.
I mean, clearly they felt you were ready.
I said to my husband, they're making the biggest mistake of their lives. Mm-hmm. Well, when my numbers started to roll in that first year, I realized I get this magazine for whatever reason. I love it and I get it. And it was tremendously successful during my 14 years there, and I loved every single moment.
So did you turn it around?
What happened is Helen Gurley Brown was a brilliant editor, but Cosmo was showing its age a little bit. And this woman, Bonnie Fuller, had come in, and she really did a great job repositioning it, refreshing it, renewing it, really redesigning it. So what I did was I had to take it from there and take it into the 21st century. One of the big changes I made was in tone. I could see that Gen X and Gen Y were so cheeky. And people used to always say about baby boomers that women, they didn't like a lot of humor in their magazines. We heard that again and again. And I just decided I'm going to make this irreverent and cheeky in a way it had never been before. And I think that played a big role in driving the numbers even higher and higher.
Can you give certain specifics about that? Because Cosmo was out there
to
begin with.
Yes, it was always out there, but in an almost breathless way, not in a totally cheeky, irreverent, funny way that, like, we once ran a cover line that went something like, how to get a guy to stick around for as long as you want him, or mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember, but the idea was, hey, just, you know, we were irreverent about how we did things. And I started having all the captions be cheeky and funny. I introduced a couple of columns like
snarky?
That. No, not snarky.
Okay.
Just irreverent. And readers love that.
Did you worry when you took over Cosmo, just forget Bonnie Fuller for just a minute, that you were no Helen Gurley Brown? And that magazine, you know, could have been called the Helen Gurley Brown magazine
yes.
in a sense, you know?
I knew I was no Helen Gurley Brown, but I knew I didn't have to be. I wasn't the inventor. It had already been created.
Sure.
I just knew that I was smart enough not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I threw a lot out, but I kept that DNA. And mm-hmm. I kept, Sandy, you said something about over the top. I never turned that off. And I would ask myself every day, what have I done today to break the law? So I remember one time I ran a cover line, "Your Vajayjay, Our Guide to Your Lovely Lady Parts." And somebody who ran our UK offices of all the magazines over there, the UK division. He comes into my office one day, a couple months later, he goes, "Well, I can't believe you ran the word Vajayjay on the cover." I said, "Oh, you happened to notice that on that issue?" And he goes, "Notice it? The whole company was talking about it." But they never said anything to me. But you had to be running things like that. Cosmo, because Helen had made it over the top, you had to stick with that.
Sure.
But I tried to make it over the top for millennials and Gen X, which was different than for baby boomers. They just had different goals, different needs.
Yes, yes. We are different. I see that.
Yes, yes. And the sensibilities were different. One of the first things I did when I got there, because it was the first magazine that I wasn't in the demographic for, that I had edited.
Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic.
I hired this great woman, Jane Buckingham, who runs a company called Trendera, who's an expert on Gen Y and Gen X. I'd known her mom, and I knew her, and I made her a consultant. So I read every single email. I did focus groups. I rated every single thing in the magazine. I read once Twitter happened, I read every tweet. I read literally anything I could get my hands on about my reader. And what made it possible for me to take this magazine that had already been created, so I didn't have to be
you didn't
as
have to
brilliant
reinvent
as
it. Mm-hmm.
Helen, was just to hear what the reader had to say, to really understand that someone in circulation once said to me, "Cosmo's kind of unambiguous to edit if you pay attention." And boy, that was true.
Mm.
I just let the reader tell me what she loved. And one of the things that happened after I left was, I think there wasn't enough attention paid to what the reader wanted, and the sales reflected it. And so this fabulous number two of mine, who's now running it, she so gets it. The big mistake I see people make sometimes in business, even in their own careers, is they're not paying attention to information. You have to be brave enough to look at it and mm-hmm. say, ouch, they didn't think I did a good job in that interview. And that's
the flexibility
clear. Right.
that comes with it, as
right.
opposed to the presumptuousness, you know,
right.
I know what I'm doing, and, you know, be dismissive
yes.
of other things.
Step back. And you have to do that with fiction, too. I'm not a big believer in getting too wrapped up in Amazon reviews, but sometimes you do see a common thread, and you might say to yourself, you know what, I didn't wrap it up well enough in that book, perhaps, as I should have, or maybe I could have done this a little bit. I think it's really important to listen.
I'd like to get into Bailey Weggins. So how was that character born?
Oh, in some ways, she's the girl I wanted to be, because that part of me that always loved freedom, Bailey is a crime writer who's works in the magazine business. And in the book that comes out in October, she's out of the magazine business because the magazine business just can't support people like her anymore. But basically, she's a freelance crime writer who has gigs at magazines, and she goes and she writes about crime, and of course she ends up solving them. And that was how a part of me wished I could live my life. So I tapped into that soul of a freelancer that I've always had.
But she also is a part of you. I mean,
yeah.
Clearly in
yes.
terms of her career, you're also writing what you're familiar
right.
with.
Exactly. You know? But I do think that, particularly with the standalones and with The Secrets You Keep, with the character Bryn Harper in it, I'm not like her. There's a little part of me. She has some writer's block initially because she's been in an accident, and so she's having a kind of a tough time recovering from this accident psychologically. And I tapped into periods early in my 20s when I had writer's block, but I do think you can only use so much of yourself in characters.
Sure.
You do have to kind of sit down and in the early stage of writing the book, really think about her, think about how she's different than you, think about what her goals and motivations are, what her secrets are, things that you may not even put in the book, but motivate her.
And so do you just churn these books out? And I don't use that in a pejorative way. I mean, book 11 is done and 12 you're getting ready for 12 or
well,
whatever.
It is a bit more of a churning process than I'd ever like, because what they want you to do in this world, readers want a new book every year. They've come to expect it because Lee Child does it and Harlan Coben does it. So they want you to do it too. So when you are finishing up one, you've already better have an idea for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people could probably start cold, but I can't. I need to have the idea. I'm a plotter. There are some mystery writers who call themselves pantsers. They go by the seat of their pants.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm a plotter.
Okay.
So it is churning. And yet, in some ways, as much as I would love there was one period where I got them to extend it to 18 months. Sometimes work expands to fill the time allotted, and I think it's more aerobic for me mm-hmm. to do it in a year.
I can't believe we've run out of time, but I want to ask you this really important question. Do you think Kate White will write her memoir?
No, it would not be interesting enough.
You don't think you have an interesting career story to share?
I think I've had a great career, and I think I've done some good things,
mm-hmm.
but it's the Helen Gurley Browns who deserve the memoirs. And I was happy just to be someone who could take something great and take it into the 21st century and write fiction books that readers like and write to me and say, hey, when's the next one? But to me, that's not the stuff that memoirs are made of. But it's a heck of a fun life, Sandy.
It sure sounds like it. And it also sure sounds like you're going to be doing this for as long as you can be doing this.
Well, I just signed a contract for a couple more Baileys. So I figure that'll take me for a while. And then maybe I'll say I just want to enjoy the view in Uruguay and not worry about
it. I think it's just
it.
So exciting. And it's really exciting when it becomes a labor of love and the bonuses of being on the New York Times bestseller list. It's nice when all the ducks line up in a row like that, and that you can be kind of the master of your own fate.
Well, you do a little bit of trying to master it, and fate gets in the way.
Oh, yeah,
but I do believe that you can really try to call the shots and take some control.
It sounds wonderful. I really enjoyed meeting you, Kate.
Thank you so much, Sandy, for having a conversation with me.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.